everything I ever had. I used it up like a broke down engine, an empty cup, a dying city, a losing team. I need another dream. Never been anywhere that felt like home.
From Los Angeles, California, that's blues singer, songwriter, and guitarist James Armstrong, one of my favorites, with Another Dream. It's from his 2000 album, Got It Going On. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and what's going on? There's a lot going on today. Well, we'll take a rest from the carnival show. There's one scheduled tonight. MSNBC is going to be doing one. We had one last night that was CNN's turn at the Dog and Pony Show. And tonight, supposedly, at MSNBC is going to be a one-on-one true debate between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. You know, just for your information. We're not going to deal with that here. I refuse to be. We discuss these things for our purposes, which is to learn things from them, not to promote them, because that's not my job. I'm not part or an extension of their PR campaigns. But we listen to what they say, if it is worth noting, so that we learn something. And in this spirit, I bring you today a favorite of yours. I refuse to claim him. And that is President Obama. In a highly publicized speech that he delivered yesterday at the Islamic Society in Baltimore. It was his first visit, by the way, to a U.S. mosque as head of state. President Obama ostensibly was playing the role of domestic peacemaker-in-chief. He was calling for religious tolerance and a rekindling of the Jeffersonian Founding Fathers' commitment to religious freedom for all Americans. Got quite a bit of play. But I tell you, when you listen to what people are saying, and sometimes, you know, I think before they give these speeches, they ought to have some people who are listening, paid to listen, if it comes to that, to the various levels of meaning, the several levels of meaning in what they're saying. Now, I will play you as much of that speech. It's about more than half of it, but I'll play you as much as we could stand, so that we can see a very disturbing thing. This speech was so disturbing on so many levels, and nobody seemed to have gotten it. It looks as though, you know, that's my job. My job is to be the one person in America who is going to translate what was said. That seems to be my job. This thing was just so disturbing on so many levels and for so many reasons. I just had to share it with you. I know it's a sacrifice. You have to listen to it. But after we listen, we will dissect. Okay, so here is President Obama speaking at the Islamic Society of Baltimore yesterday, a speech that got incredible coverage and reaction and praise. And all I could say is, Lordy, 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 so wrong in so many ways. Here he is.
This mosque, like so many in our country, is an all-American story. You've been part of this city for nearly half a century. You serve thousands of families, some who've lived here for decades, as well as immigrants from many countries who've worked to become proud American citizens. Now, a lot of Americans have never visited a mosque. And to the folks watching this today who haven't, think of your own church or synagogue or temple. And a mosque like this will be very familiar. This is where families come to worship and express their love for God and for each other. There's a school where teachers open young minds. Kids play baseball and football and basketball, boys and girls. I hear they're pretty good. Cub Scouts, Girl Scouts meet, recite the Pledge of Allegiance here. With interfaith dialogues, you build bridges of understanding with other faith communities, Christians and Jews. There's a health clinic that serves the needy, regardless of their faith. And members of this community are out in the broader community, working for social justice and urban development. As voters, you come here to meet candidates. As one of your members said, just look at the way we live. We are true Americans. So the first thing I want to say is two words that Muslim Americans don't hear often enough, and that is thank you. Thank you for serving your community. Thank you for lifting up the lives of your neighbors and for helping keep us strong and united as one American family. We are grateful for that. Now, this brings me to the other reason I wanted to come here today. I know that in Muslim communities across our country, this is a time of concern and, frankly, a time of some fear. Like all Americans, you're worried about the threat of terrorism. But on top of that, as Muslim Americans, you also have another concern, and that is your entire community so often is targeted or blamed for the violent acts of the very few. The Muslim American community remains relatively small, so several million people in this country, and as a result, most Americans don't necessarily know, or at least don't know that they know, a Muslim personally. And as a result, many only hear about Muslims and Islam from the news after an act of terrorism, or in distorted media portrayals in TV or film, all of which gives this hugely distorted impression. And since 9/11, but more recently since the attacks in Paris and San Bernardino, you've seen too often people conflating the horrific acts of terrorism with the beliefs of an entire faith. And of course, recently we've heard inexcusable political rhetoric against Muslim Americans that has no place in our country. No surprise, then, that threats and harassment of Muslim Americans have surged. Here at this mosque, twice last year, threats were made against your children. Around the country, women wearing the hijab, just like Saba, have been targeted. We've seen children bullied. We've seen mosques vandalized. Sikh Americans and others who are perceived to be Muslims have been targeted as well. I just had a chance to meet with some extraordinary Muslim Americans from across the country who are doing all sorts of work. Some of them are doctors. Some of them are community leaders, religious leaders. All of them were doing extraordinary work, not just in the Muslim community, but in the American community. And they're proud of their work in business and education and on behalf of social justice and the environment and education. I should point out they were all much younger than me, which is happening more frequently these days. And you couldn't help but be inspired hearing about the extraordinary work that they're doing. But you also could not help but be heartbroken to hear their worries and their anxieties. Some of them are parents, and they talked about how their children were asking, are we going to be forced out of the country? Are we going to be rounded up? Why do people treat us like that? Conversations that you shouldn't have to have with children. Not in this country. Not at this moment. And that's an anxiety echoed in letters I get from Muslim Americans around the country. I've had people write to me and say, I feel like I'm a second-class citizen. I've had mothers write and say, my heart cries every night thinking about how her daughter might be treated at school. A girl from Ohio, 13 years old, told me, I'm scared. A girl from Texas signed her letter, a confused 14-year-old trying to find her place in the world. These are children just like mine. And the notion that they would be filled with doubt and questioning their place in this great country of ours, at a time when they've got enough to worry about, it's hard being a teenager already. That's not who we are. We're one American family, and when any part of our family starts to feel separate or second class or targeted, it tears at the very fabric of our nation. It's a challenge to our values, and that means we have much work to do. We've got to tackle this head on. We have to be honest and clear about it, and we have to speak out. This is a moment when, as Americans, we have to truly listen to each other and learn from each other. And I believe it has to begin with a common understanding of some basic facts. I express these facts, although they'd be obvious to many of the people in this place, because unfortunately it's not facts that are communicated on a regular basis through our media. So let's start with this fact. For more than 1,000 years, people have been drawn to Islam's message of peace. And the very word itself, Islam, comes from salam, peace. The standard greeting is, Assalamu alaikum. Peace be upon you. And like so many faiths, Islam is rooted in a commitment to compassion and mercy and justice and charity. Whoever wants to enter paradise, the Prophet Muhammad taught, let him treat people the way he would love to be treated. And for Christians like myself, I'm assuming that sounds familiar. The world's 1.6 billion Muslims are as diverse as humanity itself. They are Arabs and Africans. They're from Latin America to Southeast Asia, Brazilians, Nigerians, Bangladeshis, Indonesians. They are white and brown and black. There's a large African-American Muslim community. That diversity is represented here today. A 14-year-old boy in Texas, who's Muslim, spoke for many when he wrote to me and said, we just want to live in peace. So here's another fact. Islam has always been part of America. Starting in colonial times, many of the slaves brought here from Africa were Muslim. And even in their bondage, some kept their faith alive. A few even won their freedom and became known to many Americans. And when enshrining the freedom of religion in our Constitution and our Bill of Rights, our founders meant what they said when they said it applied to all religions. You know, back then, Muslims were often called Mohammedans. And Thomas Jefferson explained that the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom, he wrote, was designed to protect all faiths. And I'm quoting Thomas Jefferson now, the Jew and the Gentile, the Christian and the Mohammedan. Jefferson and John Adams had their own copies of the Quran. Benjamin Franklin wrote that even if the Mufti of Constantinople were to send a missionary to preach to us, he would find a pulpit at his service. So this is not a new thing. Generations of Muslim Americans helped to build our nation. They were part of the flow of immigrants who became farmers and merchants. They built America's first mosque, surprisingly enough, in North Dakota. America's oldest surviving mosque is in Iowa. The first Islamic center in New York City was built in the 1890s. Muslim Americans worked on Henry Ford's assembly line, cranking out cars. A Muslim American designed the skyscrapers of Chicago. In 1957, when dedicating the Islamic Center in Washington, D.C., President Eisenhower said, "I should like to assure you, my Islamic friends, that under the American Constitution and in American hearts, this place of worship is just as welcome as any other religion." And perhaps the most pertinent fact, Muslim Americans enrich our lives today in every way. They're our neighbors, the teachers who inspire our children, the doctors who trust us with our health, future doctors like Saba. They're scientists who win Nobel Prizes, young entrepreneurs who are creating new technologies that we use all the time. They're the sports heroes we cheer for, like Muhammad Ali and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Hakeem Olajuwon. And by the way, when Team USA marches into the next Olympics, one of the Americans waving the red, white, and blue will be a fencing champion wearing her hijab. Ibtihad Muhammad, who is here today, stand up. Come on, let me... I told her to bring home the gold. Not to put any pressure on you. Muslim Americans keep us safe. They're our police and our firefighters. They're in Homeland Security, in our intelligence community. They serve honorably in our armed forces, meaning they fight and bleed and die for our freedom. Some rest in Arlington National Cemetery. So, Muslim Americans are some of the most resilient and patriotic Americans you'll ever meet. We're honored to have some of our proud Muslim American service members here today. Please stand if you're here, so we can thank you for your service. Part of the reason I want to lay out these facts is because in the discussions that I was having with these incredibly accomplished young people, they were pointing out that so often they felt invisible. And part of what we have to do is to lift up the contributions of the Muslim American community, not when there's a problem, but all the time. Our television shows should have some Muslim characters that are unrelated to national security. Right? Because it's not that hard to do. Now, there was a time when there were no black people on television. And you can tell good stories while still representing the reality of our communities. Now, we do have another fact that we have to acknowledge. Even as the overwhelming majority, and I repeat, the overwhelming majority of the world's Muslims embrace Islam as a source of peace, it is undeniable that a small fraction of Muslims propagate a perverted interpretation of Islam. This is the truth. Groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIL, they're not the first extremists in history to misuse God's name. We've seen it before across faiths. But right now, there is a organized extremist element that draws selectively from Islamic texts, twists them in an attempt to justify their killing and their terror. They combine it with false claims that America and the West are at war with Islam. And this warped thinking that has found adherents around the world, including, as we saw tragically in Boston and Chattanooga and San Bernardino, is real. It's there. And it creates tensions and pressure that disproportionately burden the overwhelming majority of law-abiding Muslim citizens. And the question then is, how do we move forward together? How do we keep our country strong and united? How do we defend ourselves against organizations that are bent on killing innocents? And it can't be the work of any one faith alone. It can't be just a burden on the Muslim community, although the Muslim community has to play a role. We all have responsibilities. So with the time I have left, I just want to suggest a few principles that I believe can guide us. First, at a time when others are trying to divide us along lines of religion or sect, we have to reaffirm that most fundamental of truths. We are all God's children. We're all born equal with inherent dignity. And so often we focus on our outward differences and we forget how much we share. Christians, Jews, Muslims, we're all, under our faiths, descendants of Abraham. So mere tolerance of different religions is not enough. Our faiths summon us to embrace our common humanity. O mankind, the Quran teaches, we have made you peoples and tribes that you may know one another. So all of us have the task of expressing our religious faith in a way that seeks to build bridges rather than to divide. Second, as Americans, we have to stay true to our core values, and that includes freedom of religion for all faiths. I already mentioned our founders, like Jefferson, knew that religious liberty is essential not only to protect religion, but because religion helps strengthen our nation. If it is free, if it is not an extension of the state, part of what's happened in the Middle East and North Africa and other places where we see sectarian violence is religion being a tool for another agenda, for power, for control. Freedom of religion helps prevent that, both ways. Protects religious faiths, protects the state from, or those who want to take over the state from using religious animosity as a tool for their own ends. That doesn't mean that those of us with religious faith should not be involved. We have to be active citizenry. But we have to respect the fact that we have freedom of religion. Remember, many preachers and pastors fought to abolish the evil of slavery. People of faith advocated to improve conditions for workers and ban child labor. Dr. King was joined by people of many faiths challenging us to live up to our ideals. And that civil activism, that civic participation that's the essence of our democracy, it is enhanced by freedom of religion. Now, we have to acknowledge that there have been times where we have fallen short of our ideals. By the way, Thomas Jefferson's opponents tried to stir things up by suggesting he was a Muslim. So I was not the first. No, it's true. It's true. Look it up. I'm in good company. But it hasn't just been attacks of that sort that have been used. Mormon communities have been attacked throughout our history. Catholics, including most prominently JFK, John F. Kennedy, when he ran for president, was accused of being disloyal. There was a suggestion that he would be taking orders from the Pope as opposed to upholding his constitutional duties. Anti-Semitism in this country has a sad and long history, and Jews were excluded routinely from colleges and professions and from public office. And so, if we're serious about freedom of religion, and I'm speaking now to my fellow Christians who remain the majority in this country, we have to understand attack on one faith is an attack on all our faiths. And when any religious group is targeted, we all have a responsibility to speak up. And we have to reject a politics that seeks to manipulate prejudice or bias and targets people because of religion. We've got to make sure that hate crimes are punished and that the civil rights of all Americans are upheld. And just as faith leaders, including Muslims, must speak out when Christians are persecuted around the world, or when anti-Semitism is on the rise. Because the fact is that there are Christians who are targeted now in the Middle East, despite having been there for centuries. And there are Jews who've lived in places like France for centuries, who now feel obliged to leave because they feel themselves under assault, sometimes by Muslims. We have to be consistent in condemning hateful rhetoric and violence against everyone, and that includes against Muslims here in the United States of America. So, none of us can be silent. We can't be bystanders to bigotry. And together we've got to show that America truly protects all faiths.
All right.
Okay. Which brings me to my next point. As we protect our country from terrorism, we should not reinforce the ideas and the rhetoric of the terrorists themselves.
All right. Okay. Thus spake the President of the United States, Barack Obama, at the Islamic Society of Baltimore yesterday, and I am going to ask you, you know the drill, what would you say about this speech? What did the President achieve here? What did he do? And why am I so offended by this speech? 888-874-4888. I mean, it sounds good. He has, you know, the cadence and the language and the tone and everything is just right. But there's so much wrong here with the speech. Were you able to detect it? Did you get a couple of the faux pas here, the wrongness of the speech? And there were so many things wrong with it. I can't imagine that it slipped by and you didn't get it. This speech that the president apparently had been saving for a long time, because this is his final year in office, and he did find himself eventually to a mosque. And there he was to make this historic speech. And for the life of me, I couldn't find, I was doubting my ears. I was saying, is there nobody in the entire White House who was able to say, hey, hold on. Let's rethink this a bit, because there's a lot wrong here. Is there nobody in charge of saying to the president, you can't do this right now or ever? This is not what you're supposed to do. This is not a good idea. And why am I so rattled? Could you figure that out? And why should you be so rattled by the speech? Oh, it's going to be a tough one today. But we do have some takers. From New Jersey, Lewis. What's wrong with this speech?
Oh, my God. What's wrong with this speech?
I'm just give going me to the, one that, the one thing that screamed at you from the very beginning. What happened here?
Well, the patronizing tone.
Ah!
Really,
let's talk about that.
Overwhelmed
what is,
me.
What is the patronizing tone here?
If you be good Americans, you're going to be, you know, house Negroes instead of field Negroes. What really punched me in the stomach was the allusion to Muslims who serve in the armed forces. It was, oh, like cold water being splashed in my face, reminding all of us one more time that African slaves can be trained to supervise other African slaves. Jews can be trained to run concentration camps, and Muslims can be trained to murder Muslims. I'd like to add that many in the Arlington National Cemetery were killed in places where we are waging war, asymmetrical war, against civilians, Muslim civilians. So, I mean, basically, that's my major objection. And secondly, this is probably tangential to the discussion, but as a reductive materialist and an existentialist, I get really tired of references to God in these people's speeches, whether it's Obama or Hillary or any of them. And There's a lot more, but I'm going to stop right here.
I'm glad you touched that, but there's a very significant thing up until the point that we cut off the speech, about 30-minute point or so. What was significant about that, that very thing that you are referencing now about God?
Well, equating the gods of the three major religions and also equating discrimination against Jews with discrimination against Muslims. Right now, I don't see discrimination against Jews costing thousands of lives, but I do see two countries that have been destroyed in the last 20 years causing a massive refugee problem, and both of those countries were Muslims. Both of those countries were run by rather secular Muslims, but they were Muslim nevertheless. I'm talking about Libya and Iraq. I've read estimates of death tolls in Iraq that surpass 1 million. I don't think discrimination against any other group has had that cost in dead and wounded. I'm going to cut it off there, tell you that I love you very much, and I really appreciate your program. Goodbye.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your contribution today, and you certainly got us started. What I was referring to is, here's a president appearing for the first time in a mosque. And he's talking about God, as Lewis has said. He just absolutely refuses to have it come out of his mouth, the name for God that the Muslims use, Allah. He refuses to say it, even though he's there, you know, preaching religious tolerance and everything. But I want to start even earlier with the craziness of the speech. This speech was not talking with Muslims. It was talking at them. And it was really talking to white America, using this venue as a convenient backdrop. Because if you really wanted to talk to the Muslim community, you would find yourself in Dearborn, Michigan. You'd find yourself in Chicago, where you came from. You'd find yourself in the Los Angeles area with a large population of Muslims. You'd find yourself in the New York metropolitan area. That's where you would go. If the idea is to symbolically embrace the Muslim community, and you would talk about Muslim America. Muslim America also includes the Nation of Islam, right there in Detroit. But you can't go to Detroit because you have a history there. And your party has a rotten history there. And there is Detroit there in Detroit. You know, the city that you bailed out and left basically to rot. And just not too far from Detroit, you have another city called Flint. You can't go to Michigan. And you can't go to Chicago. You can't go to Chicago and address Muslims in Chicago. You can't do that. So you go where it's convenient, Baltimore. And even in Baltimore, you manage just the same to sever Baltimore, the city, and what has been brewing in that city from this particular talk. It's the safest and most convenient place for you to go. It's just a hop, skip, and jump from the White House. You could go there and zip back home in time for din-din. So it's very interesting how this president, in my view, insulted the Muslim community, even though he is insisting he's addressing and be addressing them and appearing to defend them. But he makes a very egregious error here, and it's historical. The Muslim presence in the Americas, and specifically in the United States of America, predates the so-called civil rights era, or as he refers to it, colonial times even. We have it on record that the African presence in the Americas dates before Columbus's time. And in fact, we have on record in the 1500s, Estevanico, by the way, he was a pilot of a boat for the Spanish. Most of the African slaves who were brought, some of them from royalty, captured, brought here in chains long before Europeans ever got here. And certainly by the time they got here and began the slave trade in earnest. Here we have an African-American president. He's guilty on both counts by denying the history of Africa on his father's side and refusing to acknowledge the history of America on his mother's side, both of which have to do with Muslims. Because a large percentage of African slaves brought here into the United States were, in fact, Muslims, converted by force in many cases, by invading Arab armies. And African Muslims in the United States, I will refer you to a book. I think you should get a copy of it. It's a book written by, I have it written here. I made my notes. I'll find it in a minute. It is called The African Muslims Enslaved in the Americas by Sylviane Diouf. D-I-O-U-F. It is well documented. Slavery and Muslims are inseparable. And Muslim America is more diverse than this president acknowledges or even suggests. So he's erasing history and revising history at the same time. Muslim America very much is entwined with African America and slavery. And the Christian ethic that he refers to, the Jeffersonian Christian ethic that he refers to, he should be ashamed to say something like that to Muslims, because Jefferson was a pederast, a child molester, a rapist, a deadbeat father, a deadbeat dad, creating children by a young child, creating slaves, and then refusing to acknowledge them. But this is the Jeffersonian model that he's touting. Because Jefferson, he says, embraced or championed religious freedom. And it wasn't that people found or thought Jefferson to be a Muslim. That too is a distortion of historical fact. It was that they suspected that Sally Hemings, the child that he repeatedly raped, was Muslim. How about that, Mr. President? And then he goes from there to commit other really awful things, awful policy statements. And in the end, he makes the Muslim community responsible for the fact that they're being attacked by supremacist white America. This speech, I tell you, is a study in how completely disjointed, how completely removed from reality and from history and from fact this president is, and what service he does for this system. Every Muslim ought to be offended by this. And every decent person ought to be offended by this speech. But when you trust that the media is doing its job of stultifying people and confusing them and not giving them the information they need to have to make sense of their reality and their world, you can do this kind of stuff and get away with it. And you can have CNN and MSNBC and all of these other folks repeating your stuff, airing your garbage all day, telling us what a fantastic historic moment that was. And you could even have disillusioned people who themselves are cut off from their history embrace this kind of nonsense, this propaganda, this pernicious propaganda. And in the end, it is just as Lewis says, it is condescending, a calculated condescension, both to the Muslim community and to all decent people. Because in the end, the intention here was to use this moment, this group of people, this mosque, this place, this time, simply to shore up the currency, the flagging currency of the Democratic Party, and to basically keep in the minds of the public the illusion that the Democratic administration would be far more sympathetic to them, and it is the precursor of the crass exercise of going into the Muslim community and exhorting them to exercise the hard-won franchise. So when you have a point of reference, when you don't divorce yourself from your historical memory, this kind of nonsense looks meaningful. And you're likely to pay attention. And you're likely to think of it as praiseworthy. But when you understand where we are, when you do have a historical memory, this thing that this president did yesterday was so, so offensive. On so many levels, I lost count. Yet another reason, yet another reminder about the nature of politics. Yet another reminder of Amos Wilson's admonition that oppression requires you literally to be out of your mind. The nonsensical looks sensible. Idiocy looks great. Propaganda sounds like truth. And this is the gift of Barack Obama, to be the spokesperson for the system to keep us stupid. Keep us stupid and oppressed. I'll leave it there for you today, but I do want to encourage you, if you can, to look and listen to that speech. Look at it if you can. It's on YouTube somewhere. I'm sure you can find it. And certainly it's on the White House website. That's where I found it. And pay attention to it. And learn always that when people are speaking, there are several layers of meaning that they're communicating. It's very sophisticated these days with the aid and abetting of the media to dumb us down. But it is very, very important. And I suppose in a way, in a tangential way, hinting at Black History Month here, if you're at all even vaguely familiar with Black history, you can't help but find that this speech was just an absolute abomination. Thank you for joining me. I really do appreciate the opportunity to present these things to you and to present my views. And certainly tomorrow we will do that when you present your views on Free Your Mind Friday. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, a really great program. You want to stay tuned for that. And you can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. Let me know what you think of this program. A pleasure always, and a great privilege to be in your company. And now, I say goodbye to you until tomorrow. Bye-bye. Nowhere to go.
get so lonely. Makes me wanna scream. Whoa, I need another drink.